This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. And, you know, the weather has been unseasonably nice, and I think many of you are getting out there and hopefully getting out and enjoying the weather. Get outside, get fresh air, get some walking in, which always helps our overall health. Today, I've been looking forward to today's program because my guest today is Dr. Kapil Melavidu. Dr. Melavidu is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Connecticut, and he's director of blood and marrow transplantation, but he's a hematologist. And there are so many diseases that are complex that affect our blood circulation. And specifically, there are a lot of different types of cancers. And there are so many because many of these are treatable, and it's hard to distinguish. It's such a changing dynamic field when we hear about somebody with acute myelogenous, acute lymphatic, multiple myeloma, all these blood dyscrasias, these blood diseases and cancers, so many are treatable. And I'd like to investigate that much further. So he's going to take us through hematology in general, and we're going to chat about some of these blood cancers and how they are being treated. As you heard and you've been hearing, the Listeria infection goes on. And, you know, this is this foodborne infection that came from deli meat and came from one specific plant in Virginia. 59 people are ill, 10 people are deceased now, just from Listeria monocytogenes infection. It emphasizes to us the importance. This is just one plant, one food plant that did not keep to the standards of good sanitation. And our food supply is so important. We cannot hedge on what it takes to enforce the rules and to inspect these plants. And I think this is a sobering situation that we must also really take light of when we are thinking of how to spend tax money and how to investigate these things. So let's keep that in mind. This day in medicine, September 28, 1895, is when Dr. Louis Pasteur died. Now, almost everybody knows about Dr. Pasteur. And if you don't know about him, you've heard about pasteurization, the process by which we were able to sanitize milk and wine so that it was clear of various infections, various organisms. He was also key in discovering and working with vaccination and fermentation. He was a French chemist and bacteriologist. But, you know, as always, when I go through these, I learn some different things about them. I mean, his contributions to medicine in relation to hygiene, public health, and modern medicine are really the foundations we work off of. That's why this story about the Listeria really relates to this, because, you know, he died in 1895, and it really was the mid-19th century when we learned the importance of having cleanliness and sanitation in our food supply. But one thing was, in 1862, he conducted, you know, what we would consider just a basic experiment where he disproved the theory of spontaneous generation. So there was this belief that microbes and microbial infections just formed out of nowhere. So what he did was he took a sterilized sealed flask and left it. He took another sterilized flask, but did not seal it. He left it open. And over time, he was able to demonstrate that it was only in the open flask that microorganisms prospered and grew. So again, he demonstrated that if there is no exposure, right, you cannot spontaneously start having microorganisms form. It seems so basic, but he won one of the really outstanding international prizes because it really changed thought. You know, you're hearing a lot about, over the last couple of weeks, head injuries, which is my area of expertise in neurology. We saw a quarterback, Tua Tagovailoa, when he hit his head for the third time. So every pundit had an opinion as to whether he should come back and how many concussions are the worst and things such as that. Then this week we saw Brett Favre, a famous quarterback, saying that he now has Parkinson's disease. And I think when it comes to Parkinson's disease and movement disorder, you know, probably the most famous situation was that of Muhammad Ali, and everybody felt that his Parkinson's came from his years of boxing. And no one has clearly proven that. You're going to hear a lot of that, but no one has clearly proven that it is purely from hitting your head. Now, bear in mind, hitting your head repeatedly is not a good idea by any means. Is it the sole cause of people having dementia, behavioral disorders, Parkinson's disease? Probably not. I mean, these are multifactorial problems. We know a lot has to do with genetics. So there are other factors that we need to take into consideration. So you cannot just assume that if someone played a contact sport, violently contact sport, such as in combat sports, that they are naturally going to go on and have a devastating neurologic disease. You know, the other thing you have to understand is concussion is a syndrome. It's a group of symptoms of transient neurologic impairment after someone has a biomechanical force applied to the brain. And we talk a lot about, you know, how many concussions are too many. And again, it's all relative. Patients are different. They have a different threshold for injury. And also you have to take into consideration the force of the injury. I've seen injuries that were quite impactful where they've had a skull fracture and yet never developed the typical symptoms we see of concussion. So again, each patient is an individual. I often say, if you've seen one concussion, you've only seen one concussion. And it's important to know that. So when we're trying to judge from the sideline, well, that was number three, so it's over for that person. That's not the case. Also, you know, how long does it take to diagnose a concussion? I heard someone say, well, for some reason, when they saw this player, it only took them 5 minutes and it should take at least an hour. Not really. I mean, if someone is hit and has a loss of consciousness, there's a good chance that they had a concussion. So it doesn't take a lot of diagnostic testing. It's a clinical diagnosis that you can just put together. Again, it's that syndrome where we're seeing a lot of the symptoms, whether it be headache, confusion, memory loss, inability to keep their balance. So we take that all into consideration. The most important thing is that if you have a concussion, or if you have a child or a grandchild who you suspect may have had a concussion related to sports, get them to see a physician who sees a lot of concussion. because there are so many approaches to it. You know, it saddens me to see young people who are out of sport when their injury had nothing to do with concussion. It may have been a migraine headache or dehydration that caused some of these symptoms, yet they've been kept out. So again, go out and seek out a physician who has experience in seeing a lot of concussion and treating patients with concussion. We're going to take a short break. We're going to be back with my guest for what's really an extended interview with Dr. Kapil Milavidu, and we're talking about blood diseases. If you have questions for me, you can get them over to me live here at the station at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce my guest today. My guest today is Dr. Kapil Milavidu. Dr. Milavidu is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Connecticut. He's director of the Blood and Marrow Transplantation Program at the University of Connecticut. He's a hematologist, and he's here to talk to us about some of the questions we have about diseases of the blood. Kapil, welcome to the show.
Hello, Tony. Thank you very much for inviting me to your Healthy Rounds interview session. Happy to be here.
Thank you, especially since I know you're just recovering from being under the weather a little bit, and I really appreciate you taking time with us today. Can you tell us all a little bit about your training? What goes into becoming a hematologist, and maybe why you chose hematology as a specialty?
Yeah, so my journey started with my medical school back in India. I attended a medical school called Calico Medical College in Kerala. And then I moved to U.S. where I did my residency here in Bridgecote Hospital, Yale Nevin Health System. So my interest in hematology kind of started, I would say, through my residency itself, which made me pursue a dedicated fellowship in hematology and oncology at the University of Connecticut Health Center. And then throughout my fellowship, I felt very strongly about the curative potential of blood and marrow transplant in many of the aggressive blood cancers, which really made me passionate about this whole field and wanted me to know more about it. So I spent another dedicated year going to Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, where I had my full training for blood and marrow transplant as well as cell therapy treatment options.
Can you tell us, really kind of describe what the field of hematology is? And I know we often associate it with oncology, so maybe you could touch on what hematology is and why it's always linked to oncology.
Yeah, great question. I think you know, I'll have to give you a long answer for that. I think you can briefly describe what hematology means. But the way that oncology and hematology is connected as a revolving door, I think it can give you kind of more than one example for that. So basically, the field of hematology, heme is blood. So anything that relates to blood and blood disorders fall under the subspecialty of hematology. So the common, you know, disorders or diseases that fall under the specialty of this and taken care of by the specialist in hematology includes, like, you know, more common things like iron deficiency anemias, blood clots, sickle cell anemia. Some people have a tendency to have more bleeding issues. So all of those are what we call as a classical hematology or benign hematology, because they are blood disorders, not necessarily blood cancers. And then there's also within hematology a whole section called as malignant hematology, which is where a lot of the blood cancers are dealt with. And there's a lot of them which we can get into. So that's really broadly what consists or comprises the field of hematology. There are some areas of hematology which also touches upon lab medicine and transfusion medicine as critical components of training and, you know, expertise as well. So how is it that oncology and hematology has become kind of, you know, a single specialty, at least within U.S.? I know, like, you know, world over, there are still institutions where these are done as separate trainings. I think, you know, the whole thing started off way back as when medical oncology was considered really a treatment specialty for very advanced cancers. But then, you know, huge developments have happened where the field has grown so much that it requires us to kind of detect cancers early, treat cancers much more differently with targeted treatments. And also a lot of the side effects, you know, we have to know. So one of the themes that goes in parallel, Tony, is, you know, a lot of the protocols, including some of the chemotherapy agents that we use for blood cancers and also for like solid medical oncology cancers. We call it solid oncology, where like, you know, you have a solid organ that has cancer, like breast cancer and lung cancer. A lot of the chemotherapy protocols are comparable or similar or has the same drugs. And any, you know, chemotherapy drugs or protocols when you give for a specific cancer, one of the very common side effects is low blood levels or low blood counts. So how to manage a low blood count and make a common treatment decision that's best for the patient often is decided between the specialist of hematology and oncology. Another area of overlap is, as we know, that any cancer diagnosis increases the risk of blood clots for that particular person. So how to manage a blood clot in the setting of an active cancer management is also where we collaborate quite a bit. And these days, again, you know, we have come a far way in cancer detection, and many solid cancers can even be detected before symptoms or scans manifest the cancer. And the common example, which is not new, is actually prostate, where, you know, a blood test is what actually detects a risk of formation of cancer, which leads to further workup. So again, you know, there are many different ways where I could think of oncology and hematology playing hand in hand. So most training institutions now have adapted to train oncologists in the field of also hematology. So when they come out to practice, they have the basic understanding of what happens within the realm of blood in the context of cancer treatments.
You know, Kapil, I find it just fascinating as to how these fields, because when did we develop the field of hematology and oncology within medicine? Was it in the 20th century? Is it earlier? When did we start having programs address that, or was it more recent?
Yeah, excellent question. So I think, you know, again, you know, medical oncology was developed as a subspecialty of internal medicine. That happened in the 1970s, because before that, again, you know, this whole field of medical oncology was non-existent because there were surgeons and radiation doctors
right.
who used to offer, you know, surgery and radiation treatments, even the medical part of the treatment. It was, you know, it was kind of their job. But I think the field kind of evolved thanks to many effective chemical therapies that came upon in the field of oncology, which, you know, some examples are very broad, so I can kind of quote that. One of the drugs that became a cornerstone in leukemias or blood cancers is methotrexate, that required a medical knowledge, a thorough medical knowledge to offer that drug. Similarly, you know, alkylating chemotherapeutic agents became very effective in many solid cancers. And the third would be like, you know, hormone therapy that is very effective in breast cancer. So all of these, I think, developments really led to the necessity of forming a separate specialty within internal medicine. And that's how really medical oncology first came upon. I believe it was in the 1970s, early 1970s, that became a dedicated specialty. Hematology.
That's what I was thinking. You know, yeah, that's what I was thinking as well. Only because I still remember the time when surgeons would, you know, they'd do a mastectomy and prescribe cobalt therapy or things such as that. So, as you mentioned, it usually came into the field of the surgeon who may have removed the organ. We're going to take a short break. And then we're going to be back. We have so much to discuss with Dr. Melavito. If you have questions, you can get them over to me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and My guest today is Dr. Kapil Milavidu, who is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Connecticut. If you wish to reach out to Dr. Milavidu, his phone number at the office is 860-679-8992. Kapil, before the break, we were talking a little bit about hematology in general, and I think maybe it's worthwhile for us to kind of take a walk through the components of blood and maybe the life cycle of blood cells. You know, we always hear about the bone marrow and doing bone marrow biopsies, but can we kind of walk through that whole life cycle of blood cells and in the normal rotation of things?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, understanding the components of blood is really, you know, the core basics of how we treat these as well. So I think it's a very, very relevant topic to go through for the listeners. So blood, as we kind of see, you know, in the more common parlance, is like, you know, when you go to the office or doctor's office or, you know, any test that you have to get done, you just, you know, see many tubes that they collect. And what you see come out is like obviously red in color. So, you know, more than 95% of blood is fluid, water, or some other, you know, component. But there's millions of smaller cells which are inside the bloodstream, and that's what we want to know as treating physicians when we ask for blood tests. Now, you know, where do these blood tests form? Where do they come from? And then the way that I think about it is the factory or the birthplace of all the blood and the components are really the bone marrow. Mm-hmm. Bone marrow is that squishy part inside the person's bone, and we all have had some idea about that. But, you know, it presents throughout the long bones. But by the time a person is in the adult age, I think it's mostly concentrated in the pelvic area or in the long bones, like your hip bone or your shoulder bone area. So that's really the factory, Tony, of all the blood cells that are made.
When after blood cells kind of outlive their usefulness, then what happens to them?
Yeah, so great question. So again, you know, all of these small cells start with what we call as a stem cell. That's kind of the mother cell, which, you know, gives rise to all the red blood cells, we call it, white blood cells, which are, you know, helpful for a person's immune system. And then platelets, which I kind of see as a God's gift to us as like our own Band-Aid, meaning if you were to get cut, you know, the platelets are the one that stops the bleeding before we can do much. So all those cells first mature in the bone marrow. So they're very baby cells, and they have to go through many levels of development. And once they're, you know, big enough, so as to speak, to perform the job that we just described, they're released into the bloodstream, which is where we measure most of the time. And to your point, actually, Tony, I mean, regarding lifespan, you know, most of the blood components, once they have a lifespan, like you said. So the longest that, you know, lifespan is for red blood cells, which is almost around 3 months, followed by, again, you know, white blood cells, which are much more shorter, like, you know, a few weeks, and then platelets are even shorter. So all of these cells, once they have kind of gotten old in a way, they are taken to another few organs within the body. One of the most common organs is called a spleen, which sits on the left side of your belly, like under the rib cage. And again, you know, the way that we within the scientific world call, as you probably remember, Tony, from medical school days, is it's graveyard of, you know, blood cells. Mm-hmm. So that's where, you know, a lot of these blood components or the blood cells are kind of, you know, dealt with, where they complete their lifespan. But a lot of the, you know, stuff that makes up the blood is recycled. So it really becomes like not lost. So and a lot of those components are reused to make more blood cells.
You know, I never really thought of it that way in terms of a great recycling project. But I had a question come in from Bob, and he said, could you ask your guest about stem cells? And it's something you just mentioned. You know, stem cells are now the miracle drug. It's kind of like going to Lourdes. Everybody's got stem cells to treat everything. Can you talk a little bit about stem cells And I don't want you to go into the specifics of these treatments because there's so many of them out there. But if you could talk a little bit about stem cells, what they are, and how they may have some healing abilities.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that's a very, you know, very relevant topic as well. So stem cells are, like I said earlier in the talk show, is really, for me, it's like a mother cell. It's a cell that has the ability to give rise to a lot of mature cells. And the more important principle that defines a stem cell is this ability of the stem cells to self-renew. For example, it's like you going to an ATM and taking your money out and your balance is not changing. So you have so much of reserve of stem cell in your body, much more than your lifespan, that you have this replenishment capability that's hidden inside your body. And now blood stem cell is only one form of stem cell. A lot of people do get confused when I bring up stem cells because there's a lot more other areas or tissues in the body where stem cells like this reside. For example, like retina, like, you know, bone cartilage, muscles. So these are all different kinds of stem cells, which are there right from the time of, after conception, when the embryo forms and then that starts developing. All these tissues kind of retain a mother cell, call it the stem cell, which then, you know, becomes your reserve for the rest of your life. So a lot of people don't need that. Yeah, sorry.
No, you were getting right to it.
Yeah, so a lot of treatments, actually, when you hear in the common parlance about stem cell therapy, you just have to kind of, you know, dig a little bit more because there's a lot of hype, I would say, about some stem cells having some great regenerative, potential. Some remain still unproven. But the field of blood and stem cell transplant is the most advanced and has the most, I would say, longstanding history of the curative capability of stem cells in rejuvenating and, you know, getting rid of cancers like blood cancers. But yes, there's, you know, definitely an entire field in itself called as regenerative medicine, which is where they try to learn and utilize the potential of stem cells in other issue areas, like I just mentioned.
Let's kind of move on a little bit and let's talk about some of these conditions that we hear about. And you know, going up in medical school, we go to acute myelogenous leukemia, acute all the different leukemias, lymphomas.
Yeah.
Can you give us some overview of what it is you deal with in terms of bloodborne cancers? And, you know, which of them, you know, I always hear, well, that's one of the curable ones, right? So when we hear about Hodgkin's disease now, it's almost commonplace that, you know, well, they had Hodgkin's disease when they were a child, and it's like nothing. So can you kind of go over briefly all of these and give us some idea of what you deal with on a day-to-day basis?
Right. So blood, you know, cancers can be boxed into many different buckets, so as to speak. So one of the most, there are different ways that people kind of think through it, but I could start with one of the more common ones and the one that, you know, you see a lot more in the adult population is leukemias and lymphomas. Now, leukemias are, you know, specifically, again, cancer of blood cells. You know, it could be anywhere a problem within the stem cells all the way to a mature cell. So that's what you call leukemia. Now, leukemias itself can be classified as more acute, which are more lethal and more, you know, life-threatening. And the two of those are acute myeloid leukemia, like you just mentioned, Tony, and the other one is called as acute lymphoid leukemia or acute lymphocytic leukemia. Now, in adults, though, you know, acute myeloid leukemia is like more than 90% of the time. ALL or acute lymphoblastic is really a pediatric or a young adult leukemia. Now, they are both treatable. They are both potentially curable. ALL is curable even just with chemotherapy alone these days, with or without requiring a stem cell transplant. A ML, on the other hand, except barring a very few subtypes, majority of them would require a stem cell transplant for a cure. So not everybody may be eligible to get through something intense like that. So those are acute leukemias, Tony. And then there's like, you know, under leukemias itself, there are chronic leukemias. One is called a CLL, which can present as a very indolent blood count rise, and people can live very, very long even without a treatment. But some do require treatment. And they, you know, kind of have gotten to a point where it becomes like a chronic disease, which itself is why you call it CLL. It can be controlled, but they do need to be on some sort of a medications. Early on, again, you know, transplant was curative for this, but it's more toxic. So we have a lot more effective, simple drugs for CLL where people can live very, very long with just like, you know, very less side effects. And then there's CML, which is chronic myeloid leukemias also, which is very effective therapy these days. You know, it's curable just with pills. You don't need anything else. So that's one of the best, I think, advancements in the last two decades also. So CML is highly curable. So those are the acute and chronic leukemias. And one of the other more commons that I see in my hematology clinic is lymphomas and also multiple myelomas. These are also considered blood cancers. Now, lymphoma reason is because, you know, they present as tumor masses, Tony, as you know, like the lymph nodes. But, you know, the lymph nodes are made up of the blood cells' lymphocytes, which is why a lot of the times lymphomas are dealt by the hematologist. And be it Hodgkin's lymphomas, like you said, is highly curable. Non-Hodgkin's, it depends. It's a very, very broad umbrella of non-Hodgkin's. Some are curable. Very counterintuitively, you know, generally more aggressive lymphomas on the non-Hodgkin's are curable, whereas there are very less aggressive lymphomas, which may or may not even need treatment, but they kind of stay on and has a risk of coming back without causing major trouble in the vast majority. And then there is multiple myeloma, as you know. This is another very common blood disorder because myeloma itself starts from a blood cell called a plasma cell when it becomes a cancer. That remains incurable. I think, you know, there's huge effort these days, and we have made vast, vast progress in multiple myelomas to get it to cure. But unfortunately, so far still, I think, you know, very treatable, very controllable, but cure still seems to be a little far away for us.
I like the fact that you brought up at what stage of life we see them. So because we're always hearing about children who have a leukemia of some type. And are these relatively curable? I mean, I have some professional athletes who had leukemia as a child and are playing at the highest level of their sport. Has that become common now?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, really, really, yes. To the short answer is it's very curable, especially the more younger kids are. Like, you know, some do get diagnosed within the first decade of their life, as it can be highly stressful, as you can think about, you know. But they do need to go through a prolonged treatment course, but oftentimes they are very curable, more than even 90% of the time you can get rid of those without even needing a stem cell transplant. I mean, that's the beauty and the advance that we have made. And you're absolutely right. I think, you know, people get back to their life and then they have a very long life ahead, you know, which is a huge, huge advance. Now, you know, we are trying to, and again, these are a lot more common, like you said, I think in the teenage years and also, you know, in the first decade of life. But the adult percentage of these ALLs, we call it, there are some specific subtypes of ALLs, which do happen in people who are like 50s or 60s or beyond. That is, you know, that there has been tremendous advances also in the outcomes for those ALLs, including, again, a potential cure, trying to avoid a transplant. But comparatively, pediatric outcomes are way, way far better. And I don't treat pediatric leukemias, but I do get a lot of patients who are kind of in between, where, like, you know, who are young enough that they're old enough that they're not more, you know, pediatrician age group, like, you know, beyond like 18 and 19 and 20. They're called as young adults, but unfortunately they do get some of this. And yeah, I do have a lot of, you know, successfully treated, happy young individuals with the same leukemias, which is always happy to see.
Is the success in young people based on the fact that, especially in infants, you said, in the first decade of life or even in infancy, because their marrow has not fully matured, so that, you know, you can alter things. And conversely, are the cancers, the blood cancers you see in older people, more malignant because they lack that elasticity, for lack of a better term, of their bone marrow?
Yeah, I think both are right reasoning, logical reasoning. So the more understood reason why childhood ALL behaves a lot more better prognostically, outcome-wise, than an adult ALL is really because of the way the cancer biology is slightly different in the same cancer between the children's and the adults. So one of the, you know, fine tuning that goes into any ALL prognostication is dependent on some of the mutations or the chromosomal changes or the DNA changes that we can identify. So it seems like the mutations or the chromosomal changes that happens or leads to a young or a childhood ALL seems to be what we call as a very favorable mutation. Compared to that, there is a lack or less incidence of such mutations in the adult population. So by default, by the biology of the leukemia development itself, it seems like younger children are at an advantage because they don't get that aggressive clone. And the second point, Tony, that you kind of alluded to is, yes, because you have a younger marrow, you have a younger healthy person, and they generally have no other health issues, the tolerance capability of any treatments that we have to offer is tremendously higher in the children and young teens. I mean, again, you know, they're so much resilient. They bounce back from any, you know, side effects compared to like 60 plus or, you know, 50 plus, where you have other health issues, diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease. For sure, that competes against a lot of complications, you know. So this is really why it seems like, you know, children's fare a lot more better than adults and outcomes in ALL.
Kapila, maybe let's take a step backward. If when someone presents to their doctor, what are their symptoms? And they go see their doctor presenting with a group of symptoms, and suddenly their physician comes to the conclusion that they have a blood cancer. They have one of the conditions we've just been talking about. What are typically the symptoms someone will present with, and how is a diagnosis made?
Yeah. So there are many different ways, you know, that a blood disorder or blood cancer, that the ones that we covered just a little while ago, Tony, that can present. So the more chronic variants, which are actually a lot more common in the 60s and 70s, like the ones that I said at CLL, often comes to the attention of a primary care doctor where the patient has like really no symptoms. They're just going for a routine blood work and they're not feeling sick. They have no fever, no infections, nothing. And this is like their annual, and you get a blood work and you're like, oh, the white blood cells look highly abnormal. And there's a very simple test that you can do in the blood itself, which is called as a flow cytometry, where you're basically, you know, measuring and looking each of these cells under a special flow cytometer machine. And based on some signatures that these cells show, you can actually diagnose them with CLL. That's one of the more common chronic indolent, you know, leukemias that we pick up in the older population. AML, on the other hand, is a lot more acute leukemia, where the presentation can be a lot more dramatic. People come to me, come to the ER, fatigue, short of breath. Some people are having dizziness. You know, they have sometimes very scary, you know, symptoms of noticing blood coming out, or sometimes people also come into attention where they just went in because they were feeling a little sick, and then your blood count shows dramatic changes in your white blood cell count, in your red blood cell count, and your, you know, platelet count. So those people need to be generally, you know, admitted to the hospital for an expedited workup, because AML can be life-threatening if left untreated for a while. And you have to undergo, you know, additional blood tests, and also oftentimes the diagnosis made after the biopsy of the bone marrow. which is what we kind of alluded to, because it's kind of the birthplace of all the cells. And if there's a problem in the factory, you got to go right to the factory to find out what the problem is. Now, that's the leukemias generally. CML, again, you know, is a rare occurrence now, but they can present either as without symptoms or sometimes very non-specific symptoms like, you know, fullness after they eat something and they feel like, you know, they have a little bit discomfort in their stomach because spleen, one of the organs, can be bigger in CML. Sometimes it's, again, just a blood work and they don't have a lot of symptoms. And then you, you know, get diagnosed with, again, more blood tests that you can diagnose CML. Now, lymphomas can also vary in their presentation. Again, you know, it could be a simple, you know, palpable lymph area or a little tumor mass that you can feel that gets somebody to, you know, a doctor's attention. Sometimes, again, you have done a scan for something else. You have a belly pain, you have a, you know, breathing issue, and you find that there's like a lump. And then, you know, a lump could end up being a solid cancer versus it could always end up being a lymphoma. Some of these lymphoma folks also have like these undiagnosed or recurrent episodes of, you know, fever and losing weight. And sometimes we call it like more advanced stages have what we call as night sweats, where people are like really, you know, uncomfortable at night because you have so much of sweats. Now, none of these symptoms are specific. I really want to caution a lot of the listeners because we all get some of these symptoms every now and then.
Yeah.
You know, what I often worry is people kind of jumping into this conclusion because overall, of all the cancers that is there, these lymphomas and leukemias account for like 5 to 10%. So the odds of somebody having these symptoms, excuse me, and getting diagnosed with this is much more less common than the more common cancers like, you know, breast cancer, prostate or lung cancer, things like that. So I think these are all the ways some people can present, Tony, but I would say, like, you know, always call your doctor and check with your physician or, you know, have a low threshold, you know, don't wait around too long.
Kapil, I want to thank you. Thank you for your time today, especially, you know, we didn't even get into the topic of bone marrow transplantation, bone marrow treatment, but I did want to. We have about 30 seconds. Can you tell our listeners, people who want to donate bone marrow and become a donor, how do you go about doing that?
Yeah, so it's a very fairly easy process, Tony, for that. You know, if you just go to Google, which everybody these days know how to do, and if you just type in how to become a bone marrow donor, almost the first one or second link would be what is called as National Marrow Donor Program, or NMDP. And the first link pops up saying, like, join the registry. There are four steps involved in joining the registry and becoming a bone marrow donor. Once you click the join the registry link, it'll help you, you know, it'll walk you through it. It's very self-explanatory. You just have to give some, you know, information of your name and email and your address. Because once you're, you know, put in that information, it'll also ask you some very simple basic medical questions to make sure that, you know, you could be a potential donor. And then once that's done, they mail in a swab to your address, which is a cheek swab. You can just, you know, swab it, and it's a self-address kit that they send. You put it back, you send it back, and you are now part of the registry. Now, being part of the registry itself doesn't mean that you are a donor. You are a donor. Yes, you have voluntarily expressed your interest to become a donor. But then, you know, the registry, the way that registry works is that there's a potential patient. They cross-check the registry to see who is a match. If the person in the registry is a match, they get a call from NMDP and say, like, hey, this is, you are found to be a perfect match for this, you know, patient who is in Texas or who is in California, who is like maybe even out of the U.S. Are you willing to kind of donate? And oftentimes the donation involves like collecting the stem cells from your vein. You don't have to get a bone marrow biopsy per se these days. Nice. It's a very straightforward process. One of the important things for the listeners is generally the age cutoff is 40 or less. So, you know, if we are more than 40, I think there are other ways you can engage with bone marrow transplant donation process, be participating like in bone marrow drives, which actually happened recently in stores. And also I think in Middletown, where you can just walk in and then do the swab right there. So that's another way you can become a bone marrow donor.
Kapil, thank you. Thank you again for your time today. I'm going to get you back again soon because I have so many more questions, and I know our listeners do, about marrow transplant and treatment of these cancers. Many thanks to Kevin Corza, who's been on the board today, and Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing, as always, for Healthy Rounds. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.